Okay, thank you very much for the invitation and the invitation to speak here. I'm going to tell you about biotechnology and its applications. I'll start by talking about the beneficial applications of the technology and then go into some of the dual-use implications of the technology. And by dual-use, I'm talking about technologies that can be used for good or for illicit purposes. I'll give you somewhat of an assessment of the risks and the capabilities of the technologies, and then wrap it up by telling you about how we're dealing with this challenge. And I'm going to try to leave you with the idea that trends in biotechnology actually suggest that from a security perspective, things are getting better rather than worse. Biotechnology, broadly defined, is basically using biological systems like living organisms or their derivatives and put them to work for us. And what's really propelled this area forward in the last 50, 60 years is molecular biology, or the ability to manipulate DNA molecules. And these started with the key experiments in the Cavendish labs in Cambridge, where Watson and Crick, using Rosalind Franklin's data, managed to solve the structure of the DNA. And that was followed up by another very important experiment in 1961, where Francis Crick and others figured how it is that DNA encodes for proteins. They cracked the genetic code, so to speak. And that was a very important experiment because it eventually led to our ability to take DNA and manipulate it, thereby manipulating proteins. And since living systems are made of proteins, humans acquired the ability to change the properties of living systems, like viruses, human cells, or bacteria. And of course, that's had tremendous contributions in a number of areas, and I'll just give you some examples of that. In healthcare, for example, malaria kills 2 million people each year and is increasingly becoming resistant to a number of drugs. There's no effective vaccine. This is a drug, it's called artemisinin, that's usually found in a plant, but that plant is somewhat of a rare species, and the extraction of the drug is quite difficult. Well, a group of researchers have managed to move the genetic circuitry of that drug into bacteria, and they're now working on getting the bacteria to mass produce that drug. And we're seeing the same technology being applied toward energy production, where we're seeing researchers trying to move genes into bacteria that will ultimately allow the organism to produce long hydrocarbon molecules that are found in petroleum. So bacteria and yeast typically do produce ethanol, but those are short. These are the much longer, more efficient ones. And then there's, of course, advances in food security. Depending on which continent you're on, this is either an advance or a risk. But I'm using a less controversial example where researchers have managed to move genes from a particular rice species that's resistant to drought conditions, so it needs less water to grow, into a rice species that's high yield. And then you get out a high yield variety that's also resistant to drought, therefore requiring less water. But of course, all of this technology that I'm talking about, the underlying technology is dual use. And again, these are intended to serve humanity, but also bring with them the potential to harm. And when we talk about these risks, we talk about two kinds of risks. There's the unintentional risks or deliberate acts, such as hostile acts. I'll just quickly deal with the unintentional risks. These might include, for example, the escape of a pathogen from a highly secured laboratory facility. And we have examples of the SARS virus or the Ebola virus infecting laboratory workers who unknowingly take the virus into the outside environment. Just last year in the United Kingdom, there was an outbreak of foot and mouth disease virus. And it's a very infectious and contagious disease of cattle, and it happened to have originated from a vaccine facility which had a faulty drain, where the virus actually escaped and infected the nearby animal farms. Now, other unintentional risks might for example, include where a set of experiments are done where the consequence can't necessarily be anticipated in advance. So, for example, our genome is littered with retrovirus genomes. By genome, I mean the entire DNA of a virus. And a retrovirus has this special ability that when it infects a cell, it can actually integrate its genome into the host cell. And over the course of evolution, these viruses have bombarded our genomes, and they've become integrated permanently into our DNA. And a lot of them just sit there. They don't express themselves. But as we reproduce, they also reproduce their genomes, but not the actual virus. Well, to understand the role of these sequences better, one group actually went into human cells and they cut out the entire genome of a particular retrovirus. You can then introduce that DNA that you cut out into cells, which you can readily grow in a laboratory, and the cells essentially serve as factories for the virus. And they managed to produce this virus, which was described in this paper. And from a scientific point of view, of course, this is a really neat experience, because essentially what you're doing is you're bringing a fossil back to life. But of course, it raises a host of questions as well, like what is the point of resurrecting viruses that we have never seen before, our immune systems have never seen before, and therefore have no immunity against. Now, this was a case where the virus turned out not to be a strong one, but of course it did raise a lot of those questions. Now, this is an example where we still needed to go into the human cells to cut out the DNA of that particular virus. But DNA technology has gotten so good that we can now simply synthesize DNA from scratch. So we don't need a template anymore. We can simply take information and turn that information into product. And that's because of advances in two technologies, DNA synthesis technology and DNA sequencing. And by sequencing, I mean we're simply reading the DNA. It's just information. And by synthesis, we're taking that information and turning it into physical material. And you can see the advances of DNA sequencing and synthesis over time, and this is shown by how many nucleotides of DNA we can actually read or synthesize per day. And what's this done is it's enabled us to sequence literally thousands of genomes of organisms and place those genomes in a public database. Now, one particular genome that was sequenced was the 1918 influenza genome, where, as Professor Oxford mentioned, scientists went to the permafrost, took out samples of this human who had been killed by this virus. They sequenced that DNA, and then another group took that sequence and made the actual DNA itself and managed to resurrect the 1918 influenza virus, which was described a couple years ago in a science paper. Now, just incidentally, you can actually order by mail from companies these DNA sequences. Now I want to emphasize that 1918 experiment is an important one, and it taught us a lot of things. For example, we know now that it was a bird flu virus, and we know that because we sequenced the virus, and that has public health implications as we prepare for the H5N1 pandemic. But through experiments that we have done with that virus in animal models, we also know that one of the mechanisms with which it kills was to send the immune system into overdrive, causing what's called a cytokine storm. And this, in part, explains why the 1918 influenza was so deadly to the healthy sort of middle-aged 20 to 45 age group who had healthy immune systems. It was because it sent their immune system into overdrive and the immune system turned on their bodies. And finally, as any other basic research experiment, there's unanticipated benefits that we may not know of today, but surely we'll find out in the future. On the other hand, as we heard, it was one of the greatest pandemics in human history, where it killed 50 million people and infected a third of the people worldwide, and in some remote areas where there was no natural immunity to influenza viruses, such as parts of Alaska and Africa, nearly all inhabitants died. And so, of course, what we worry about is that these tools will fall into the wrong hands. And in some sense, this is really an unprecedented threat when a few people or even technically competent individuals gain access to tools that can produce so much damage. Now, these are cases that I've told you about where we're creating viruses from scratch. But we can actually also, using these genetic engineering tools, we can also manipulate and change the properties of these organisms. The exact same technology that goes into manipulating a DNA and therefore a virus to make it, to attenuate it, for example, in order to use it as a vaccine, that same technology can, of course, be used to enhance the virus for illicit purposes. And perhaps the greatest concern here is the potential to enhance the smallpox virus. Now, the smallpox virus may have killed between 3 to 500 million people in the 20th century, more than all conflicts combined. And this is despite the fact that there was an effective vaccine against the virus, so the number would have been even higher had that vaccine not existed. And the concern is, of course, that somebody will get a hold of the virus and make it vaccine resistant or enhance it in some way. One of the papers that really sort of raised this potential in the community was a paper where a group of Australian researchers took mousepox virus. So this is a cousin of smallpox. It doesn't infect humans. It infects mice. And they had different intentions in this experiment, but what they ended up doing inadvertently was to create a mousepox virus that was resistant to the mousepox vaccine, and it overcame even genetic immunity that these mice had by simply adding a gene called interleukin-4, which misregulates the immune system into the virus. And of course, that brings the implication for a similar kind of experiment happening with smallpox, which is a close cousin of mousepox. And I say if because we don't know if interleukin-4 would have the same effect on smallpox. Of course, there are different viruses. They infect different species. But just the idea that you could do a similar kind of experiment to smallpox to make it resistant to the current set of vaccines would really leave us vulnerable, especially given the current pace of vaccine production and scaling up, which is quite slow. Now, fortunately, smallpox has been eradicated from the natural world. This was one of the greatest accomplishments in the 20th century, where the WHO coordinated efforts of various countries through a huge vaccination campaign to eradicate the disease. And we were able to do this because there's no animal reservoir for smallpox. It's strictly a human disease. Something like SARS, we wouldn't be able to do this, for example, since SARS is zoonotic and comes from animals to humans. And after this eradication, they decided to maintain stocks of the virus in only two locations, one at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and the other one is in Russia. So these are the only two sites on the planet that contain the smallpox virus. And it would be extremely difficult, of course, for anybody to go steal those samples. But the concern is that someone might recreate this virus from scratch, given that its genetic sequence is available in the database. Now, creating this virus has been difficult so far, technically, because for one thing, it has a very large genome. So it has 180,000 nucleotides. Compare that to the 9,000 nucleotides of the 1918 influenza. Technically, it's very difficult. And when we submitted our chapter, the limitation of the commercial technology was 40,000 nucleotides. This paper by the Venter Institute just came out several months ago, where they managed to synthesize a bacterial chromosome, which are much, much longer than viral chromosomes, of a 580,000 nucleotides, which is three times the length of smallpox. So that limitation, which was there before, is gone. However, there are other ones. Smallpox is a DNA virus. It's not infectious on its own. So there's a lot of other issues as well to recreating it. But again, these are just probably examples of limitations of the technology today that may not be there tomorrow. So now that I've talked about some of these capabilities, let me just step back and give you a little bit of history of the context of biological weapons. Well, first of all, it's important to remember that this is not really a new thing. Bioweapons have been with us since the beginning of warfare. It's just that the capabilities are better now. Some of the examples from later times include the famous example of the 14th century siege of Kaffa, where the Tatar armies catapulted people who had died of the Black Plague, the bubonic plague, over city walls as a means to introduce disease into the city. Not one of the high points in human history. Another example is, for example, the 18th century siege of Fort Pitt in Pennsylvania, where British soldiers distributed blankets with smallpox to Native Americans as a way to introduce the disease. But then when our capabilities got better, when we managed to figure out how disease is transmitted and how to grow up pathogens and how to store them, governments started getting more interested in this area. And we have examples both in World War I and World War II of biological weapons being used. World War I, it was strictly used in animals, but in World War II, in the run-up and also throughout World War II, Japan actually dumped a number of different pathogens on Manchuria in its conquest of China. These included ticks that were carrying Yersinia pestis, the causative agent of the Black Plague. Now, the other powers didn't use these weapons in warfare, but they did engage in massive production, stockpiling, and experimentation of these pathogens. So this is a paper from the US Army in 1966. This is before the Biological Weapons Convention went into effect. But the paper clearly describes the effect of aerosol age on the bacteria Pasteurella tularensis, which causes tularemia, on human volunteers. They wanted to see if they can aerosolize this and use it as a weapon. And that you can see the methods and materials section of this Journal of Bacteriology paper, where they describe healthy young Seventh-day Adventist soldiers participating on a voluntary basis in these experiments. Now, a few years later, in 1972, the Biological Weapons Convention went into effect, and it outlawed this entire class of weaponry. However, the problem with the convention is that there is no system of verification to see whether or not countries are engaged in legitimate activities or not. And the second issue, really, is that these technologies are so diffuse, they're so user-friendly. I told you about the case where you can actually order DNA online, that you're dealing with tools that you can really place in thousands of laboratories and within reach of small groups and individuals, which makes the problem of verification very, very difficult, since it brings the problem into the non-state and individual category. We still don't know for sure who was behind the 2001 anthrax attacks, but it was probably the work of a technically competent group or even an individual. Anthrax can cause disease in three different ways. You can either eat the stuff or drink the stuff. It can go through cuts on the skin, or it can be inhaled. But the inhalation form is the most lethal. It causes 80% lethality. And that attack was using inhalation anthrax, which requires a difficult process of what's called sporulating the bacteria. And sporulation makes it more stable over time, resistant to harsh environmental conditions, and it's also a requirement for the inhalation form of anthrax, which is what the case was there. However, that attack was probably not intended to cause mass casualties. In fact, the anthrax was delivered to individuals through mail rather than released in a crowded environment. But what's worrisome is when you do have an ideology, an extreme ideology, that wants to create that mass casualty. And we have an example of that in the Aum Shinrikyo group. This was the cult that succeeded in attacking the Tokyo subways with the nerve gas sarin. But before that, they had quite a bit of interest in biological weapons, and they had various attempts, although they failed in their attempts. For example, in one case, they tried to release anthrax from rooftops of crowded cities, crowded Japanese cities, but they failed because they got the wrong strain, and they also had other technical issues. So what you worry about is when this ideology comes together with that technically competent area. And in that sense, what has to be in this equation as far as security is also legitimate labs, perfectly legitimate government labs, academia, and industry, where that technical competence actually exists. Especially since contagious pathogens don't require sophisticated delivery systems. The 1918, for example, we know was spread around the globe simply through soldiers traveling slowly through land and sea, but today we have the much faster air travel. And these are just nonstop international flights from a single city in a single day. And given that a lot of these diseases have very short incubation periods that are much shorter than an international flight, you can actually envision a scenario where you manage to spread disease quite widely before a single index case patient even starts to display symptoms. So how do we deal with these kinds of threats? The rest of the talk, I'm going to address that issue. There's basically two strategies to think about it. One is you want to defend against an outbreak and once it occurs. And the second is you want to prevent an attack to begin with. And the defense strategy really is a bigger part of public health. Pathogens, whether they occur in nature or they evolve in a lab, ultimately cause a disease. So what we need to do is to improve public health, first and foremost. And that really involves investing in detection technologies, disease detection technologies, and some of these other public health measures, isolating the sick, closing public spaces. And I'll just kind of skip over these since Professor Oxford talked about these. And of course, countermeasures. This means investing in basic research, learning more about these organisms, investing in vaccine development and drug development, et cetera. And of course, this is all biotechnology here, right? So we have to be sure that in the process of mitigating the risks of biotechnology, we don't jeopardize these very important benefits, like understanding disease and enhancing basic research, because we know that, one line is missing from this, we know that 14 million people die each year from infectious diseases. And by comparison, 5 people died of those anthrax attacks. So it's important to have a framework that doesn't jeopardize the benefits of biotechnology for dealing with those 14 million infectious diseases. And when we talk about it, sort of that risk-benefit framework, well, it reminds you of what the nuclear folks have to deal with respect to safeguarding nuclear facilities. They have the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is in charge of surveillance and monitoring of nuclear facilities, whether they're centrifuge facilities or whether they're plutonium facilities, to ensure that legitimate activities are not diverted. Now, they can do this because these nuclear facilities are centralized. You need state programs. These are expensive, and there aren't that many of these facilities, so it's a manageable problem. With respect to biotechnology, of course, there are literally thousands of labs throughout government, industry, academia that have these capabilities. So it's really not feasible to put together an IAEA-like institution where you have people running around and inspecting labs. It would be totally counter to the culture of sharing and openness in biology to begin with. But what I'm gonna argue for the remainder of the talk is that there are trends in biotechnology which suggest that we can actually, in the future, implement these kinds of non-intrusive, that's the key, they have to be non-intrusive, surveillance tools. And these trends are basically twofold. One thing that's happening is that essential biotechnology services are becoming increasingly centralized. This is because of all the competition between the labs in industry, academia, and what's that done for us is a lot of essential services are now being outsourced. There are companies that are specializing in these essential services and serving the greater community. And from a security perspective, that makes the job of surveillance and monitoring much, much easier. Second point is that biotechnologies are becoming increasingly automated. They're advancing, as I showed you. And when that automation is key, because if you want to implement a security strategy, instead of having people do it, you can simply make an automated safety feature into that automatic technology. And let me just give you an examples of two examples of how this is being done and could be done. The first is the security framework for commercial DNA synthesis. So again, these are the guys that have the capabilities to send you the entire genome of the 1918 influenza virus. And the second is basically everyone else, because it's a very small fraction of the community that's actually using commercial DNA at this point. So what do we do about everybody else? Well, first of all, the companies, pretty simple what they're doing. Simply, when you send the sequence of the DNA that you want made to the company simply takes your DNA and screens it, cross-references it to the database of pathogenic genomes, right? So we have these databases of genomes of Ebola and SARS, et cetera. That's all. And if there's a match, if there's no match, if your DNA turns out to be an E. coli laboratory strain that everybody wants to work with, then everything's good. They make the DNA and they send it to you. But if it turns out to be the DNA of a hemorrhagic virus, cousin of Ebola, the Marburg virus, then a red flag might go up, or they don't send you the DNA, unless you've been pre-registered with the government to work with that particular pathogen. Okay, and now you might be asking, well, what happens when this technology becomes more widely available, when it actually leaves these centralized facilities and trickles into everybody's labs? Then what do we do? And this is where that automation comes in. And what we've proposed in this case is that these future technologies, so this is your DNA synthesizer, and now instead of being in the company, it's on your lab bench. And you simply stick the DNA into the computer and out comes the physical material. So what we've suggested here to make these what we call proliferation resistant. This is a term borrowed from the nuclear folks. And you can simply have a safeguard, for example, make the chip of the machine so that when it sees certain sequences, it rejects them, while the inert stuff is permissive. And again, for researchers who are authorized to work with the pathogenic stuff, they can get the more permissive technologies. Okay, so those are the ways with which we can deal with DNA synthesis. But again, like I mentioned earlier, DNA synthesis is actually a really small part of this pie. Most of the community doesn't rely on this commercial DNA synthesis for their work. Most people use traditional genetic engineering tools in their research. Means they take the DNA and they can manipulate it in various ways. Of course, they do this to make a vaccine, right? You manipulate the DNA to attenuate the virus to make a vaccine. But the same tool, as I described before, can be used to make your organism more pathogenic. So can we implement a DNA surveillance mechanism for the rest of biology? This is the question. So what we did was we looked at this experimental pipeline from DNA to protein to virus, for example, and what you need to do in those experiments. And what you find is that when you engage in these recombinant DNA experiments, at some point, you want to sequence your DNA to make sure that whatever you were intending to change in that DNA molecule or in that virus actually went into the organism, right? So you have to sequence it at some point. So as far as the surveillance mechanism goes, it would be great to simply have a lens that looks through that simply looks through whatever it is that the researcher is looking through for his or her experiments to find out whether or not the work is legitimate or not. Now, this would not have been possible just 15 years ago because DNA sequencing was all done in-house. So people were relying on these old-school gel electrophoresis techniques to sequence their DNA or sequence whatever it was that they were working with. And it would certainly not be possible because you would have to send, again, thousands of inspectors into everyone's labs. Forget it. But what's happening is that DNA sequencing is becoming outsourced. So today, 80% of the community is actually sending their DNA material or whatever it is that they want to sequence to these sequencing companies, okay? And that number is going to become much, much higher. It's going up very fast. So these companies, which are few in number, are going to be in a great position to monitor research activities because they can pretty much see whatever is coming in from the entire community. And again, this is a work in progress, but those are some of our ideas for how to deal with this other issue, the non-DNA synthesis issue. And again, those DNA sequencing companies can simply cross-reference the material that's coming in from their customers against this database of genomic sequences and see whether or not the customer is working on a pathogen that the government typically regulates or not. Now, there's, of course, challenges ahead with all of these protocols. For example, who's going to be regulating these? Who's going to be enforcing these protocols? And who decides which sequences should be regulated and who can access them? This might be an easy thing to do on a country-to-country basis. There's a number of countries that have lists of pathogens that the government controls. But these are not by any means global. For example, an agent like Ebola is perceived as a bioterrorist agent in the United States, and thus it's highly regulated. On the other hand, it's a virus that's endemic in parts of Africa. So the African researcher is not going to want to jump through hoops and hurdles to work on an organism that's endemic in his or her country, right? And in fact, this was the same issue that occurred in the United States. And in the United States, virologists lobbied the government not to regulate the SARS virus during the 2004 SARS pandemic, specifically because they wanted easy access to that virus. So these are going to be issues that we have to deal with. And of course, whatever we do, we don't want to compromise scientific openness and information sharing in any way. That's very important. But finally, I'll just leave you with this, that biologists are beginning to think about these issues and talk about these issues. There are a number of country efforts going on, as well as international ones. The World Health Organization is addressing the issue, and so is the United Nations Office of the Secretary General. And these international efforts are really critical because for any successful framework to work, it would really have to be global because biotechnology is global. And I thank you for your attention.